Hello again, Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 421 of Film Critics Favorite Films, Part 1. Christopher Llewellyn Reed, of course, is one of our critics. He teaches at Stevenson University, has worked on films, writes weekly reviews, and monthly joins our other critic, Linda DeLibero, to talk about either classic films or the current cinema here on Roughly Speaking. Today, you'll hear Chris talk about 10 of his favorites. How did you evolve into a filmmaker, film critic, student of film? How did all that come about?
Well, I can credit my mother to some degree for being a cinephile when I was young and bringing me to lots of movies and setting up birthday parties at my home, including one where we actually watched High Noon with a rented projector from the Enoch Pratt Library, because we moved to Baltimore when I was 9 years old. And so experiences like this really helped me develop early on a love of films, but I never really took it seriously as a subject to study academically. It wasn't until my first graduate program, where I was actually there to study Russian and East European studies. It was actually Soviet and East European studies, but then the Soviet Union fell apart and it became Russian and East European studies. And I was in a program where, as long as you satisfied certain basic requirements of the program, you could turn it into anything you wanted. And so I started taking courses in film studies, and I developed a real passion for the Soviet filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky, and I got a fellowship and went to Russia for 4 months to study his life and his films. And I came back from that, didn't think I was going to do anything with it beyond simply this interest briefly in cinema studies. And I taught at a boarding school for 3 years after that, a boarding school in Connecticut. And while I was there, I realized that I didn't really want to be a high school teacher. And so I applied to another graduate program to get an MFA in filmmaking, figuring that was more serious that I would do that. And so I spent quite a lot of time then studying and making films. And because of that initial background in film history, I was able, once I completed my MFA, to sort of become both filmmaker and film historian.
Chris Reed is going to list 10 of his favorite films today, from Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing to The Godfather to The Piano and the 2005 film Nine Lives, directed by Rodrigo Garcia. He even throws in a musical and a science fiction comedy. But Chris starts us in the 1940s, after World War II, with two movies that you ought to see, one that you probably have seen. The first film is The Best Years of Our Lives, directed by William Wyler. The second film, well, you're sure to recognize it, directed by Frank Capra.
These are the great personalities who bring a memorable experience to glowing life, with Myrna Loy and Frederick March living through the heartwarming second bloom of love. Dana Andrews and Teresa Wright feeling the breathtaking thrill of love at first sight. Hoagie Carmichael spreading his own brand of stardust. All of them together giving all of us the best years of our lives.
This is a film that I only saw for the first time about 5 years ago. I'd long heard about it, but somehow I had missed it. And there are plenty of films from the 1940s that I adore almost equally, like Casablanca, Citizen Kane. And yet, over the past 5 years, this film has risen towards the top because of its deeply humanistic approach to the trauma awaiting returning veterans after World War II in a film made by one such returning veteran himself, William Wyler, who had lost 80% of his hearing in a bombing run over Italy. He had been riding along other bombing runs previously, which resulted in his 40-minute Memphis Belle documentary, which is a marvelous film that you can see in many places online. And that experience had given him real insight into the experiences of soldiers overseas. And so he comes back and he makes this movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, which chronicles the adventures and misadventures of these men, three men who come back, all of different social class, all with varying degrees of trauma, either physical, one man has lost both arms, or mental, one man is suffering from what was not then called PTSD, but which is clearly PTSD in the film. And the three actors are Frederick March, Dana Andrews, and a man who's actually not an actor, Harold Russell, who was a man who had actually lost his arms during the war in a training area in the United States. So William Wyler sort of explores what it means to be an American in this time just after the war. And it's really a marvelous examination of the values that we have traditionally held dear in this country and about the challenges to maintaining those values in the face of adversity. And I've chosen a clip from the sort of second part of the film where Dana Andrews is Fred Derry. Dana Andrews plays the guy who's suffering from PTSD, who was a captain in the Army Air Corps, has now only been able to find work in the same diner where he worked before the war as a soda jerk. And he is serving Harold Russell's Homer Parrish. This is a man who lost his arms. And as Homer is eating at the counter of the diner, this other guy who did not serve in the war starts making comments about how we were fighting the wrong people, i.e., we should have been fighting the communists, and maybe we shouldn't have been attacking the Nazis because, after all, so is the implication, they were perhaps not doing anything all that bad. And, of course, we have to remember that William Wyler was Jewish and himself had been reprimanded for punching out a New York City doorman for making anti-Semitic comments while he was in the Army and had been reprimanded, had taken the reprimand. So this is an issue that's very dear to him, and we hear that in this clip.
It's terrible when you see a guy like you that had to sacrifice himself. And for what?
And for what? I don't get you, mister.
Well,
anything else for you?
Check. We let ourselves get sold down the river. We were pushed into war.
Sure, by the Japs and the Nazis, so we
had... No, the Germans and the Japs had nothing against us. They just wanted to fight the Limeys and the Reds. And they would have whipped them, too. We didn't get deceived into it by a bunch of radicals in Washington.
What are you talking about?
We fought the wrong people, that's all. Just read the facts, my friend. Find out for yourself why you had to lose your hands. And then go out and do something about it.
You better pay your check, brother, and go home.
Well, who do you think you are?
Pay the cashier right over there.
Coffee, please.
Yes, ma'am. And that's another thing. Every soda jerk in this country's got an idea he's somebody.
Look here, mister. What are you selling anyway?
I'm not selling anything but plain old-fashioned Americanism.
Some Americanism. So we're all a bunch of suckers, eh? So we should have been on the side of the Japs and the Nazis, eh?
Again, I say, just look at the facts.
I've seen a couple of facts. I've seen a ship go down and over 400 of my shipmates went with it. Were those guys suckers?
That's the unpleasant truth. And the sooner we get wise to it, the better off we're going to...
Oh, if I only had my hands.
Frank Capra, like William Wyler, had also served in the Army during the war, though he had not experienced the same trauma that William Wyler did. And he comes back from that experience after having made a 7-part documentary series, Why We Fight, and like Wyler, makes what I consider to be probably his masterpiece, It's a Wonderful Life, which stars an actor, Jimmy Stewart, who himself had been involved in running bombing runs over Germany and was very disillusioned by the whole Hollywood acting thing upon his return. And the irony of the clip we're about to hear, where he's this idealistic George Bailey defending the values of his father's Bailey Brothers building and loan against the evil Mr. Potter, is that Mr. Potter is played by Lionel Barrymore, who, according to the Making of documentary that you can watch on the disc of It's a Wonderful Life, is the one who sort of coached Jimmy Stewart in the values of the profession of acting. Post-World War II, saying, you know, young man, acting is, you know, the greatest profession. You can touch people. And, of course, here they're adversaries. But as we can imagine, behind the scenes, they were probably, and they had acted before together, but they were probably quite collegial. And so in this clip, Jimmy Stewart's George Bailey, just after his father's death, is taking on the evil Mr. Potter's values, saying that, you know, this town needs an organization like this to stand up for the little guy.
Just a minute now, hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now, you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny-ante building alone, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character, because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Right. Here, you're all businessmen here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What'd you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them, until they're so old and broken down that do you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be.
I'm not interested in your book. I'm talking about the building and loan.
I know very well what you're talking about. You're talking about something you can't get your fingers on, and it's galling you. That's what you're talking about, I know.
There's a great documentary series right now on Netflix called Five Came Back, an adaptation of author Mark Harris's best-selling nonfiction book that discusses the experience of the five Hollywood directors who went abroad or worked for the U.S. Armed Services during World War II. In addition to William Wyler and Frank Capra, there was John Huston, George Stevens, and John Ford. And I highly recommend the series if you like any of those directors. Certainly, there are many Hitchcock films that I like equally or almost as much as Strangers on a Train, but for me, this is his oddest film, which is why it usually rises to the top of my favorite Hitchcock films. It stars Robert Walker as Bruno, a deeply disturbed young man who hates his father, almost equally hates his mother, though it's more of a love-hate relationship. And one day, on a train, this spoiled, rich guy with many problems meets Farley Granger's Guy, who's a tennis pro. And on the train, this is based on a novel by the great Patricia Highsmith, he thinks that he has convinced Guy to do a switcheroo where he, Bruno, will kill Guy's wife so that Guy can then be free to marry the woman he's in love with, and he, Guy, will kill Bruno's father. Guy thinks Bruno's a little strange, doesn't think much of it, doesn't realize that Bruno thinks that they've agreed on something, and then lo and behold, when Bruno actually follows through and kills Guy's wife, Guy realizes what he's gotten himself into. Now, I chose a scene from about the midway point in the film where Bruno has crashed a society party being thrown by the family of Guy's fiance, because now he can have a fiance's family, and here he is, played by Robert Walker, whose last film this was. Here he is talking to two older women, about what one might do if one really wanted to kill somebody, and he ends up mimicking the action that he used to kill Guy's wife.
Now, you're going to do a murder. How are you going to do it? That's the fascinating part. How are you going to do it? I didn't get your name.
Mrs. Cunningham.
Mrs. Cunningham. How are you going to do it?
Well, I suppose I'll have to get a gun from somewhere.
Oh, no, Mrs. Cunningham. Bang, bang, bang all over the place. Blood everywhere.
How about a little poison? Yes.
Oh, that's better. That's better, Mrs.
Anderson.
Oh, that's better, Mrs. Anderson. But you see, Mrs. Cunningham's in a dreadful hurry. Poison could take anywhere from 10 to 12 weeks if poor Mr. Cunningham is going to die from natural causes.
You know, I read of a case once. I think it would be a wonderful idea. I can take him out in the car, and when we get to a very lonely spot, knock him on the head with a hammer, pour gasoline over him and over the car, and set the whole thing ablaze.
Then have to walk all the way home. No. Oh, no, no, no. Well, I have the best way and the best tools. Simple, silent, and quick. The silent part being the most important. Let me show you what I mean. You don't mind if I borrow your neck for a moment, do you?
Well, if it's not for long.
So I won't repeat all the many great things we said about this movie in a previous podcast, but I do love this movie. High Noon, directed by Fred Zinnemann and written by soon-to-be blacklisted writer Carl Foreman. And in this scene, Gary Cooper, Marshal Will Kane, and Grace Kelly, his new bride, have fled the town when they found out that the man that was put away 3 years prior has been released from jail and is coming back to kill Marshal Will Kane or potentially kill him. They fled the town, but now they've come back because A man's got to do what a man's got to do, and he cannot run from his duty. And, of course, this film examines these issues of duty and loyalty and doing the right thing. And here we hear all of that in this clip.
Will, I'm begging you, please let's go.
I can't.
Don't try to be a hero. You don't have to be a hero. Not for me.
I'm not trying to be a hero. If you think I like this, you're crazy. Look, Amy, this is my town. I've got friends here. I'll swear in a bunch of special deputies, and with a posse behind me, maybe there won't even be any trouble.
You know there'll be trouble.
Then it's better to have it here. I'm sorry, honey. I know how you feel about it.
Do you?
Of course I do. I know it's against your religion, though. Sure, I know how you feel.
But you're doing it just the same. Oh, Will, we were married just a few minutes ago. We've got our whole lives ahead of us. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
You know, I've only got an hour, and I've got lots to do. Stay at the hotel until it's over.
No, I won't be here when it's over. You're asking me to wait an hour to find out if I'm going to be a wife or a widow. I say it's too long to wait. I won't do it.
Amy.
I mean it. If you won't go with me now, I'll be on that train when it leaves here.
I've got to stay.
Now, I'm a huge fan of Westerns, so I could have picked many a Western in my top 10. But what I particularly like about High Noon is the way in which it explores the meaning and repercussions of violence in what has always been a very violent genre. And of course, in later revisionist Westerns like The Wild Bunch, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, we see this more and more. But at a time when Westerns had yet to really start examining the wages of violence in the way they would later, I find the way that this film does really quite exciting. There are many musicals that I could have picked, but I am not only a fan of movie musicals, but I'm also a fan of movies about movies or movies about Hollywood. And for me, Singing in the Rain is really one of the best, if not the absolute best, of movies that examine Hollywood's history. So, made in 1952, this film, directed by star Gene Kelly and his protege Stanley Donen, revisits 1927, when silent movies and all of Hollywood were faced with the challenge of how to adapt to the new technology of synchronized sound. Now, 1927 is the year that The Jazz Singer comes out, and although nobody knew that the public was going to suddenly want films where people talked, i.e. talkies, as soon as The Jazz Singer came out and we heard Al Jolson's famous line, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. Suddenly everybody wanted films where people talked. And this movie stars Gene Kelly as Don Lockwood and Gene Hagen as Lena Lamont, a gorgeous couple of the silent screen who suddenly have to figure out how to become talking film stars. The only problem is that one of them doesn't have a very good voice, and since she's such an unpleasant person in the movie, she sort of gets her due comeuppance. So in this clip, we have the head of the studio, R.F. Simpson, who walks in and stops the filming of a new Lockwood and Lamont, or Lamont and Lockwood film, by shutting down production and telling them that they're going to have to adapt to sound. And one of the other voices we hear in the background is Donald O'Connor as Don Lockwood's sidekick.
Hold it, Dexter!
Hello, Mr. Simpson.
Well, Mr. Simpson, we're really rolling.
Yeah, well, you can stop rolling at once.
Huh?
Don, Lena.
All right, everybody, save it!
Save it? Tell them to go home. We're shutting down for a few weeks.
What?
Well, don't just stand there. Tell them.
Everybody go home until further notice. What is this?
Yeah, what's the matter, R.F.?
The Jazz Singer. That's what's the matter, The Jazz Singer.
Oh, my darling little mammy. Down in Alabama. My little baby.
Oh, no, this is no joke, Cosmo. It's a sensation. The public is screaming for more.
More what?
Talking pictures. Talking pictures.
Oh, it's just a freak.
Yeah, what a freak. We should have such a freak at this studio. I told you talking pictures were a menace, but no one would listen to me. Don, we're going to put our best feet forward. We're going to make the Dueling Cavalier into a talking picture.
Talking picture? Well, that means I'm out of a job.
At last, I can start suffering and write that symphony.
You're not out of a job. We're putting you in as head of the new music department.
Well, thanks, R.F. At last, I can stop suffering and write that symphony.
Now, wait a second, Mr. Simpson. Talking pictures. I think you should wait.
Every studio is jumping on the bandwagon, Dexter. All the theaters are putting in sound equipment. We don't want to be left out of it.
We don't know anything about this gadget.
Well, you have to know. It's a picture. You do what you always did. You just add talking to it.
Yeah?
Don, believe me, it will be a sensation. Lamont and Lockwood, they talk.
Well, of course we talk. Don't everybody?
We jump ahead to the 1970s, where we have sort of the American New Wave, headed by the likes of people like Francis Ford Coppola, Peter Bogdanovich, Martin Scorsese, and really one of my favorite films of the period, if not my absolute favorite, is The Godfather, which, interestingly, is adapted from a book that's not all that great. It's a really kind of minor potboiler, Mario Puzo's novel of the same name. If you've ever read it and then watched the movie, you'll realize how much better the film is. So it's a film that is more than just a film about the mafia. It's a film about immigrant aspirations, about overcoming adversity to make something of yourself. And we hear all of that in this clip between Al Pacino. And of course, the early 70s is the time that made Al Pacino. He goes from films like The Godfather to Dog Day Afternoon to Serpico. I mean, Al Pacino is all over the early 70s. And if you watch The Godfather, you see why. He's mesmerizing as Michael Corleone, the son of the Don, played by Marlon Brando, who won an Oscar for this film, well-deserved. And in this clip, we hear the aging Don lamenting to Michael, who's taking over the family business, that Michael has had to do so because he had different goals in mind for him. And we also hear the wonderful musical theme by composer Nino Rota in the background.
I knew that Santana was going to have to go through all this. And Fredo, well, Fredo was. I never wanted this for you. I worked my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool. Dancing on a string held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that. But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone, something.
Another peso in avanti.
This wasn't enough time, Michael. It wasn't enough time.
We'll get there, Pop. We'll get there.
I'm a big fan of high-concept science fiction, and I'm a big fan of well-done comedy, and marrying the two is what we get in 1985's Back to the Future, directed by then-up-and-comer Robert Zemeckis and produced by Steven Spielberg. It stars Michael J. Fox as Marty McFly and Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown. And, of course, Christopher Lloyd at that point was mainly known for the television show Taxi. But here he shows a whole other side to his sort of crazy comic mania. And Michael J. Fox was, of course, mostly known at that time for Family Ties. But this launched him into a whole sort of bigger cinematic career. And this is a scene early in the film where Marty has gone to the mall to help Doc Brown with a project that he knows nothing about, but he's been helping Doc for a while. And he shows up on a skateboard, and lo and behold, it turns out that Doc Brown has made a time machine out of a DeLorean, which, of course, DeLorean owes much to this film because, you know, it's been a long time since the company went out of business. But thanks to Back to the Future, we all will remember for as long as we watch movies what a DeLorean is. And, of course, I love this movie because it is so much fun. It's a film about time travel where a young man goes back and sees what his parents were like when they were young and who at some point hasn't dreamed of doing that. So I love this film and I love this scene.
Jesus Christ, Doc, you disintegrated Einstein.
Calm down, Marty. I didn't disintegrate anything. The molecular structure of both Einstein and the car are completely intact.
You'll Where the hell are they?
The appropriate question is, where in the hell are they? You see, Einstein has just become the world's first time traveler. I sent him into the future. 1 minute into the future, to be exact. And precisely 1:21 a.m. in 0 seconds, we shall catch up with him at the time machine.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
The way I see it, if you're going to build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style? Besides, the stainless steel construction made the flux dispersal. Look out!
So there are many films by Spike Lee that I like, and certainly at the time that this film came out, I was ready to watch anything that the man would make, and for a number of years afterwards, until, like any director, he started, you know, having some misfires. But there's really so much to admire in this film and in Spike Lee's career. So this is a film, his third feature, in which Spike Lee himself plays a major role, something he had done starting with his first feature, She's Gotta Have It, and continued in School Days, and for a while afterwards he would play roles both minor and big. So here he plays Mookie, a pizza delivery guy in Brooklyn, working for Sal's Pizzeria. Sal is played by Danny Aiello. And John Turturro, who's acted in many Spike Lee films, plays Pino, Sal's eldest son, and he harbors a fair amount of racist views. And though the film now is almost 30 years old, I think given what's happening in our country right now, I think it's worth a revisit, since we have clearly not moved beyond many of the attitudes that we see in this film. So the film follows the events on the hottest day of the year, as it's portrayed in the film, where sort of the paternalistic way in which Danny Aiello's Sal views the residents of the neighborhood sort of ends up morphing into something more virulent by the end of the film. And it's a film that I think is one of the best cinematic deconstructions of race in America that I have seen, even to this day. I mean, there have been plenty of other interesting films, but I really like this film, and I like this scene. Just a warning, there is some language in the film that may offend some listeners, some F-bombs and the N-word, but you've got John Turturro and Spike Lee sort of going back and forth on sort of what it means to be racist or not be racist.
Pino, who's your favorite basketball player?
Magic Johnson.
Who's your favorite movie star?
Eddie Murphy.
Who's your favorite rock star? Prince. You're a Prince
fan. Boss, Bruce.
Prince.
Bruce.
Pino, all you ever talk about is nigga this and nigga that. And all your favorite people are so-called niggas.
It's different. Magic, Eddie, Prince are not niggas. I mean, they're not black. I mean, let me explain myself. They're not really black. I mean, they're black, but they're not really black. They're more than black. It's different.
It's different?
Yeah, to me, it's different.
You know, deep down inside, I think you wish you were black.
Get the fuck out of here!
Laugh if you want to. You know, your hair is kinkier than mine. What does that mean? Now, you know what they say about dark Italians?
You know, I've been listening. I'm reading.
You've been reading now?
I read. I've been reading about your leaders, Reverend Al, Mr. Dew, Sharp Tone, Jesse. Keep hope alive.
That's fucked up.
Keep hope alive.
Hey, that's fucked. Don't talk about Jesse.
And even the other guy, what's his name? Farrakhan.
Minister Farrakhan.
Sorry. Minister Farrakhan. Anyway, Minister Farrakhan always talks about the so-called day when the black man will rise. We were one day, what does he say? We were one day rule the earth as we did in our glorious past.
Yeah, that's right.
What past you talking about? What did I miss?
We started civilization.
Man, keep dreaming, man. Then you woke up.
Pino, fuck you, fuck your fucking pizza, and fuck Frank Sinatra.
Yeah? Well, fuck you too, and fuck Michael Jackson.
Every time I listen to this clip, I also have to laugh because, of course, I got my MFA from NYU and I took a class from Spike Lee. And Spike was great about letting students screen their work for him. And so one day, before Spike's class, I'm screening my second year film for Spike Lee, and somebody opens the door in the back of the room, and I run up to kind of stop this person from coming in and interrupting my screening, and it's John Turturro, who's the guest for the day for Spike Lee's class, and he's very nice, and he realizes what's going on and takes a seat. So I got to screen all of my film for Spike Lee and half of it for John Turturro. The Piano, directed by Jane Campion, is the only film on my list directed by a woman. And there are plenty more films that I have liked in my life directed by women, and particularly a lot of television, recent television, where you have women showrunners, and a lot of documentaries directed by women. But since I've kept this list exclusively to narrative feature films, and I kind of like to wait at least 10 years before I decide that a film has really impacted me over the long term, it just so happens that Jane Campion is the only director with a film on this list. But rest assured, there are plenty more films directed by women that I like and admire, and certainly a lot of more recent media output created by women that are among my favorites. But this film from 1993 by Jane Campion stars Holly Hunter, Harvey Keitel, Sam Neill, and Anna Paquin. And both Hunter and Paquin won Oscars that year, as did Campion for the script. And Hunter and Campion both won at the Cannes Film Festival. Holly Hunter plays a woman who is mute. Mute by choice, the film intimates. She's had some trauma early in his life. And she is basically sold. She's from Scotland, and she's sold as a mail-order bride to a man in New Zealand, played by Sam Neill, who has a helper, played by Harvey Keitel, who sort of half-adopted the mannerisms and the culture of the local Maori. And Holly Hunter is basically dumped on a beach with her daughter to await the arrival over land by Sam Neill and his party. And in this scene, we hear the dialogue between Sam Neill and Anna Paquin, who is delivering notes to him, which is why you hear sort of him reading off of them, and then Anna Paquin insisting on behalf of her mother that Sam Neill pay attention to them. So the film is called The Piano because though Holly Hunter is mute, she expresses her inner desires through her music. And the drama, the conflict in this first scene is over the fact that Sam Neill refuses to take the piano with Holly Hunter and Anna Paquin, leaving it on the beach. I love this film because it features amazing performances, gorgeous cinematography, and beautiful music by composer Michael Nyman. And it's really an artistic masterpiece in so many ways. And we hear just a little bit of that in this clip.
Oh, no, it can't come now.
It must. She wants it to come.
Yes, and so do I, but there are too few of us here to carry it now. Too heavy. Do you mean you don't want your clothing or your kitchenware to come? Is that what you mean?
We can't leave the piano.
Look, let's not discuss this any further. I'm very pleased that you arrived safely.
Mother wants to know if they could come back directly for it.
Could I apologize for the delay, which I regret was...
After they've taken the other things.
Might I suggest that you prepare yourself for a difficult journey? The bush will take clothing and the mud is very deep in places.
So this is a film that if you've never heard of, I suggest you go out immediately and rent either online or on disc or in any way you can. It's directed by Rodrigo Garcia, who is a son of Colombian novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And as a filmmaker of note, he's made many more films than just this. This is a film that's actually made up of 9 scenes. Scenes that occasionally have characters from other scenes, but which are really standalone scenes. And it's about 9 different women at crisis points in their lives. Each scene is a single take. So though the scenes vary in length from 10 to 14 or more minutes, there's no cutting. So it's really a masterclass in mise-en-scène, where the camera and actors have to really be well blocked, and they rehearse, you know, for a few days in order to get it just right, and the performances are allowed to therefore breathe. And my favorite scene of the 9 in this film, although there are many that I like, but for me, this scene is really the primary reason why I love this movie so much, stars Robin Wright, who at that time I think was going by Robin Wright Penn, and Jason Isaacs. And of course, Jason Isaacs, many know him as Lucius Malfoy in the Harry Potter series. Now he's on the latest iteration of Star Trek, whatever it's called. So he's a British actor, but here he's playing an American. And he and Wright are old lovers, now both married to other people. She's very pregnant in this scene, and they run into each other, and sort of all of their past connections come out. Initially, they're sort of wary of each other, but they start becoming more comfortable, and then it's almost as if no time has passed, and this fact of their inescapable connection ends up being disturbing to the both of them. And I picked just a moment from the scene that really expresses that, and it's just such a beautifully, beautifully acted movie all around, but particularly this scene.
Look at us, Damien.
What?
Walking and talking like lovebirds.
Yeah.
5 minutes with you, I just feel like my life is a figment of my imagination.
I know.
No, you don't know. No, you don't know. You've just always been this thing that swallows me. I gotta go. You can't just come up to me after 100 years, married, and tell me that you think about me. You can't do that.
Why not?
You love your wife?
Yeah, of course I do. You love your husband. This is different.
How?
Because it's us. We're Damien and Diana. We always will be. Nothing's gonna change it. Might as well accept. You know it's true.
Do you think that because you did some filmmaking that you're empathetic with the filmmaker when you're watching a film? When you're reviewing a film, you want the film to succeed? Do you ever feel that way?
I don't know if it makes me more empathetic. I mean, I can be really frustrated by bad filmmaking like anybody. I think what it does is it makes me curious often about the mechanics of the filmmaking. Now, I can get as lost as anybody in the story. And if I'm lost, then I tend not to think about these details as much. But when I am really sitting down to sort of break down why I feel a particular way about a film, because of this background in filmmaking, I think it just lends to that curiosity.
Christopher Llewellyn Reed is professor and chair of the Film and Moving Image Department at Stevenson University. He is a regular contributor to Roughly Speaking. Our other film critic, Linda DeLibero, will be with us next week to list her top choices, part two of A Film Critic's Favorite Films. This is Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun for producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Singing.